sashayed on up, and you asked me for a line. Well, you said you were home. Hello, Register Readers. This is Ashley Vance welcoming you to the third installment of Semi-Coherent Computing. This one will be codenamed Precious Bodily Fluids. And as usual, I'm joined by our hardware guru, Chris Hipp. And both of us would like to thank the thousands of you that keep tuning into the program. It still looks like this is going to work out pretty well. When we started doing this show, we mentioned that it would not be explicitly about data center computing. We hope to incorporate some history of computing aspects as well. And that's what we have lined up today. We're graced by the presence of Dr. Anthony Jameson, who is currently a professor of engineering in Stanford's Aeronautics and Astronautics Department. Anthony's resume is nothing short of extraordinary, and it would take the better part of a day for us to make our way all the way through his accomplishments. That said, we will highlight that Dr. Jameson received the Elmer Sperry Award in 2006, which is pretty much the equivalent of the Turing Award or Nobel Prize for engineering. Dr. Jameson is also a member of the Royal Academy of Engineering, and in 1973 he won $25 from NASA for a computing achievement, and then later in 1980 he won the Medal of Exceptional Scientific Achievement. He's received pretty much all of these accolades for his work in computational fluid dynamics, working for companies such as Boeing, and Boeing and others have honored him as kind of a living legend in the field. And we have his code to thank for some pretty basic things, such as cheaper airline flights from all the fuel we've saved on efficient plane designs. And also I read somewhere that when Dr. Jameson's codes crash, the only thing we have to check is the black box recorder to see what went wrong. As it turns out, Chris Hipp has kind of told me a little bit about some of Dr. Jameson's early work, and it helped generate the need for some of the early supercomputers, and that's a topic that we're going to explore in a minute. In the meantime, Chris and Anthony, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I'm very happy to participate, and this is a very flattering introduction.
Chris, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind giving us just the background on when the two of you met. I know you were at a startup, I believe, at the time, unless you met before that.
Yeah, we met at when I was working for Orion Multisystems, which was the cluster-in-a-box vendor, startup that we did a couple of years ago. And Anthony came to us because he was very interested in our box and running his code on our box, because at the time he was looking for a computer, I think, and I don't want to speak for you, but I think you were looking for a computer that was quiet and low power consumption that you could use in your house, and that's basically what we had, right?
That's exactly correct. In fact, I had this Indian student, Gurjeet Singh, and as a research project, he had to find an architecture for something like a 16 or 12 processor machine. We're thinking of trying to build it ourselves, but then he suddenly showed up and said he'd found the Orion Multisystems on the web and seemed to be what we were trying to build. So I got in touch with Orion, who turned out to be Chris, and went down there with Gurjeet and another student, Cassidit, and took a look. And then we left them one of my codes as a benchmark and did well. So I think I wound up buying maybe the first Orion that was delivered. I'm not sure, but I think it was.
Yeah. It was, in fact, the first Orion that was delivered.
And then that relationship, Chris, obviously you started getting pretty interested in Anthony's work in this field.
Well, I didn't know much about the field at the time, and I just started doing a little research and very quickly discovered that it basically, computational fluid dynamics was the early driver of high performance computing back in the early days of computing, because at that point a lot of the other fields that we know now are big drivers of high performance computing did not exist yet. So When Antony wrote the first computational fluid dynamics codes, that was basically the impetus for a lot of companies to go out and build large machines for the time to run those codes.
Right. So I think this is a subject we're going to kind of walk our way back to, but I was wondering, Antony, if you wouldn't mind, you know, telling us how you got started in all this, even further back, really. You're kind of from the UK, and I saw on your biography that you seem to travel around quite a bit as a kid.
Yes, well, I think my dad was actually a British Army officer, eventually a brigadier, and I was born in 1934, and we went to Malta the next year where my one brother was born. We were back in England for a year, and then we went to India when I was 3 years old. And then the Second World War started. My dad was sent to Iraq and then to Iran. And my mother, we couldn't get back to England anyway, so we went on living in this hill town in India, Simla, until I was 8. At that point, my father was transferred to the Burma front, and we moved to the northeast of India. And then he applied to come back to England because he hoped to have some participation in invasions of Normandy. And so we came back to England when I was 9, and I was dumped immediately in a boarding school along with my brother. I remained at boarding schools until I was 18. But then I did 2 years military service. We still had universal service in England at the time. I was sent to Malaysia. It was called Malaya in those days. I came out of that when I was 20, and I spent 6 months working in a jet engine company before going to Cambridge.
And, I mean, even at that stage, were you interested in mathematics, or was it the jet engine work that kind of got you interested in...
I fell in love with anything that could fly as a very small boy. I mean, I know I used to watch birds when we lived in Delhi. I was only 5 years old. I can remember the first plane I ever looked at, and I cannot have been more than 5 or 6 because we left Delhi after that. It was a biplane and all these sticks and strings, and I thought it was completely wrong because I looked at birds. But I did notice these movable surfaces, and I realized that if you tipped the tail up, it's going to, the elevator as it's called, then it would push the tail down and the plane could maneuver. And when I got to Simla, I found one of these airplane recognition books with things like Spitfires and Messerschmitts. And I knew all the size of the planes and their engines and so on, but I think I only found out I was interested in mathematics after I went to school, which is when I was 7, and not even for the first 2 years. It just sort of became apparent as I grew older that I really did like maths, but I also liked airplanes, and eventually I found a way to kind of merge the two interests.
Right. I found it pretty interesting looking at your biography that a lot of times academics kind of stay in their ivory tower, but you obviously found a way to find a very practical application for your passion in mathematics.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when I was at Cambridge, I had spent the 6 months in the jet engine company before, and I had been somewhat disappointed by what I saw there. I mean, people were basically acting as human computers with slide rules, and there seemed to be very little room for creativity. So when somebody asked me if I wanted to do a PhD at Cambridge, it avoided the need to find any other job. So I said yes, and I wound up doing this magnetohydrodynamics, a rather esoteric subject. When I finished, I then got while I was a graduate student, I got a 3-year fellowship from Cambridge, which is kind of like a junior research faculty position, and that was very nice. And I spent one of those years at MIT. But at the end of this time, I wasn't at all sure what to do, and I did nothing for about 6 months, and then I got myself hired as an economist in London.
That sounds real exciting.
Well, I had been negotiating with British Aerospace, and they offered me a salary, which I think it was £1,050 a year, I mean, roughly $3,000 at the time. And I said, well, that's less than you would have I'd been made if I had hired without the PhD. And they said, yes, we don't think a PhD is worth anything. And so this was kind of discouraging. And then I got an offer from IBM, ready to do computer programming. I didn't just want to do computer programming, so that I found it passed on. And then I was offered a job by the Royal Aircraft Establishment, but I didn't actually like the sort of government agency atmosphere of the place very much. And eventually I said, well, I'm going to try something else altogether. And I got myself hired by the economics department of the British Trades Union Congress. I was kind of pro the Labour Party at the time. And I had 3 weeks to learn economics before I had an interview, when I convinced them I could do the job when I got it. And,
and I mean, could you maybe, you know, when did you start doing your computational fluid dynamics work in earnest? I mean, when did you realize that's...
Well, what happened was, while I was working in London as an economist, one of the then remaining British aircraft companies, Hawker Siddeley, at that time there were two before they were finally merged into British Aerospace, was recruiting, and they had some guys in London, and I walked into this hotel, and they asked me what I could do. I said aerodynamics. They said, what are you doing now? Economics. They said, well, how do you think I could do aerodynamics? I said, I have a PhD in magnetohydrodynamics. So eventually I wound up being hired there, but with the title of chief mathematician of... And I started doing a range of calculations, both aerodynamics and antennas, all sorts of things. But I didn't think this was supposed to make anti-aircraft missiles, and it didn't seem to me we were ever going to make another one. And the guy who'd really hired me there left for Douglas one just after I got there. So finally I decided, no, I'll have to try the United States if I'm going to work in the aircraft industry. It's English... aircraft industry was just in a low point at the time. So I eventually got hired by Grumman into the aerodynamics department. And after I'd been there a couple of years, it became apparent that nobody knew how you might use a computer to calculate fluid flow. It was just wide open at the time. I mean, my management didn't realize that computers were powerful enough to do anything, and even if they did, they didn't know how to. And
What year was this?
I joined Grumman in fall of 66. It's around about 69, well, 70 when they asked me to start looking at this, in fact. And so I started writing computer programs in for fluids in 1970, 71 at Grumman. But I also came into contact with this group at the Courant Institute of Mathematics in New York University, in particular Paul Garabedian, and he eventually persuaded me to visit the Courant Institute for 3 months, and then he offered me a job, and I went back to Grumman and gave them 3 months' notice and kind of gambled on joining the group at the Courant Institute.
What kind of computers were you using then?
Well, at Grumman, we had an IBM 360, and I was trying to do two-dimensional calculations, and we had these decks of cards that were picked up by truck, and if you were lucky, the computer output was returned the following morning. It's a huge printout. This wasn't fast enough for me, and this is another weird thing. So I found out that if I waited till 6 o'clock and took my deck over to the computer center, I made friends with the guy who was on the night shift, and I got priority over the F-14 and so on, in effect, right?
Yeah, it seems like computing's full of stories.
And I did, because I... You know, it would have been better to look at each result before the next, but I used to submit 5 runs every night, 5 boxes of cards. And you had to be very careful, because if you lose a night's work if you've got a comma in the wrong place or something. But on the printouts, they would have the estimated cost of these runs. Actually, about $3,000 per run. But I was spending, according to their bookkeeping, $15,000 a night for like 18 months. I never heard a word from anybody. I mean, it's a crazy system. But the reason I did leave government is I did begin to realize that this had real potential. I got a two-dimensional code for transonic flow working before I left, and transonic flow is crucial for airplane design because it's the speed at which you wind up flying. A little bit below the speed of sound, where just before you get this big sonic barrier due to massive increase in drag. It's the best place for commercial aircraft, but military aircraft also, when they're turning, wind up in this speed. But I was trying to write these, some of my codes, on an IBM 1130, which was a thing about the size of this. Well, it was the size of a big refrigerator. But it had only like 4,000 words of memory or something like that. So at the Curran Institute, there was this group led by Gary Bedian who were, had the mathematical skills that I needed to learn, and others, people like Peter Lax, who's later got the Abel Award and so on. And it was a kind of center for numerical methods at the time, worldwide, I would say. So when they offered me the job, I thought, I'll have to gamble and try it. It's the only way to have access to the extra mathematical knowledge I needed to learn. And also they had what was then the world's fastest computer, a Control Data 6600.
So, and that did that machine have enough horsepower for what you were looking to do at that time?
Well, it was a lot more than we had at Grumman. I should explain that the reason the Courant Institute had the 6600 was that Courant himself was kicked out of Germany in the mid-30s because he was Jewish. And he was a kind of controversial character, but eventually somebody from the Rockefeller Foundation got him the job at NYU when they only had one graduate student in math. But he built this whole math department and eventually demanded that he have an institute in his own name and threatened to take it to the West Coast unless they agreed to his terms, which they did. But you can read that in a very interesting biography of Courant, by the way, by a woman called Constance Reed. But he was friendly with von Neumann, and so von Neumann was an atomic energy commissioner, and he made sure that his body had the latest computer.
Right.
So the first 6600 went to Los Alamos or something like that, and the third one was at the Courant Institute. It had 131,000 words of memory. And it was a roundabout a megaflop, very fast by the standards of the day. But I was trying to write three-dimensional flow simulations for a complete airplane wing. In fact, I did write, jointly with David Coey, who had become friendly with me, this program Flow 22, around about 1974, and that was the first code that could really calculate the flow past a swept wing of a commercial aircraft accurately enough that you could really use it for design. And because there was so little memory, you couldn't put the whole calculation in core, so we had to chop up the calculation plane by plane and put three planes in at a time. And then we had three disk files, and you would actually rotate them. So you're always writing one, let's say 1, 2, 3. So if you read one, write two, read two, write three, read three, write one. So if something went wrong, you could back up one, because the disk reads were not very reliable in those days. And one calculation took about 3 hours. The code is still in use today in, for example, Boeing in Southern California, and it runs in about 10 seconds on a PC, the same code. Of course, it's now in core, so we got rid of all the disk reads. But in fact, the code was, we let McDonnell Douglas have it in 1976, and they were running it something like five times a day at a cost of $3,000 per run. And it was used on the C-17 wing, for example, probably the first was also used in the what became the Canadair Challenger, but at that time somebody was running the code in Los Angeles because for Lear before he sold it to Canadair.
What was the mix between, you know, doing wind tunnel work and computation at that period?
Actually, I don't have it with me, but I could show you what the kind of thing McDonnell Douglas were doing. They were probably the first heavy users of this code. Later on, Boeing used a slightly later code called Flow 27, but on most of their planes between about 78 and 93, up through the 777. But they would, prior to this, people would have to build about 25 different wing models and test them in a wind tunnel. And what McDonnell Douglas did was that they calculated maybe 50 wings and picked the best half dozen and tested those. We realized that on something like a 747, there was something like 25,000 hours of wind tunnel testing during its design, and that's very time-consuming and very expensive. I mean, several thousand dollars per hour on a wind tunnel. And a wind tunnel model costs about $750,000 to have an instrumented model.
Right.
But yes, we were. They could get the result back in, well, 3 hours, so they could look at a lot of wings quickly. But what he didn't do was to tell them how to make a better wing. That still required some experience here at Nemesis to try to decide how to change the shape of the wing based on what they were seeing. This right. is what I came to later, to try to automatically find the best wing.
And Chris, I mean, this picks up on something you were saying. So pretty early on, we see CFD, computational fluid dynamics, you know, with an obvious need for driving, an obvious need for more horsepower.
Yeah, those early computers that you were using, the IBM 360s and these control data computers, those were really not high-performance computers per se. They were just the only computers that were available at the time. Is that correct?
The IBM 360 was kind of the top computer around about 68, I think. The Control Data was a kind of upstart company, but its success is based on Seymour Cray, who designed the 6600, and subsequently the 7600. And then he didn't get along with the management, who didn't seem to support his vision. So he split off and started Cray Research in the, I would think, somewhere around 1976 or 77, but I'm sure you can look up the exact date. Anyway, the Cray introduced the concept of a vector computer, and that even the Cray 1, I think, was up to something like 100 megaflops, but with not enough memory. The 6600 had been around 1 megaflop, and the 7600 maybe three times faster than the 6600. But the thing about the vector computer was that it's, from the point of view of the programmer, it's really like parallel computing, since if you have a vector you're going to operate on, say, length of 64, then each has to do a multiply, each starts one clock time later, so it's all overlapped. And from the point of view of the programmer, you might as well be parallel. So I realized, well, actually, what happened to me was that just about the time that I left the Curran Institute and started at Princeton, I was approached by a guy called Derek Robb, telephoned me from Cray. And they were being benchmarked by Boeing on the Flow 22 code, I believe. So Derek asked if I would consult for Cray on helping them get better performance in Flow 22. So I told Derek two things. Firstly, that Flow 22 is out of date because it was using a simplified flow model, a so-called potential flow, and by this time we could solve a more complete gas dynamics equations, so-called Euler equations. Secondly, the algorithm in it was absolutely not vectorizable. So I said, really, rather than trying to fix Flow 22, why don't we move forwards? I'll write you some vector codes to solve these three-dimensional gas dynamics equations, the Euler equations.
And it looks like, I mean, you've got this humongous list of codes that you've worked on. You know, is there anything about how they've kind of evolved over the years to the different computing architectures, or each one takes a little bit of customization for the problem?
Well, that was a question that I was going to ask, is, you know, how many different computing architectures have you been through? It seems like you've probably been through them all.
I think I've regrettably been through just about all of them. But I should maybe explain that in the early days of CFD, we were definitely limited by computer speed, memory, and cost. So we had to use significantly simplified mathematical models of the fluid flow to produce answers in feasible computer times. And if you're designing an airplane, you really want the answer overnight. I mean, otherwise the design process is just too slow. So by the time Cray came along, it was clear that we could solve the full gas dynamics equations. We need to learn how. And then later on, you start including the viscous effects, and you have the Navier-Stokes equations. But actually, flow with airplanes becomes turbulent, so you have to use the so-called Reynolds average Navier-Stokes equations, the RANS equations, and huge increase in memory. So for a Euler simulation on a wing, somewhere around 200 to 500,000 mesh points is enough, and for a complete aircraft, you can do with 500,000 or 1,000,000 mesh points. If it's viscous, you multiply by at least 10. You know? Million cells for a wing, 10 million for an airplane, and so the costs go up. And it's all very much paced by computers, so when I wrote the first 3D Euler solver of mine, which was Flow 57, we had an IBM 4341 at Princeton, and that was about 0.15 of a megaflop and 2 megabytes of memory. And it was a machine which had separate cabinets for the CPU and the memory and the disks and this and that. It filled a large room. Cost about $350,000. And Cray 1 was maybe 100 megaflops, it still only had like 32 megabytes of memory or something like that. By the time we got to the XMP, we were like 128, but we were really memory limited. And that meant that a lot of the codes, you had to recalculate things that might have been stored. It's better to recalculate them on the fly to save memory.
And you were saying you've regrettably had to deal with all these architectures. Has there been a favorite over the years?
Personally, I like the vector machines. But once you realize how to write vector code, it was easy. And we'll come to the convex, perhaps. But around, while I was at Princeton, I should explain that I had left the Curran Institute in 1980 because I was offered jobs at both Stanford and Princeton in aero, and seemed to me that since my interest was really in aeronautics, I ought to take one, and eventually I opted for Princeton. But when I got there, we didn't have a computer, and I managed to borrow $350,000 from the provost to buy this IBM 4341. But clearly, by the time we get to 1985, we needed to replace it, and we looked at all kinds of things, like floating point systems had some kind of vector addition. And then, kind of out of the blue, Complex showed up. There was a competing company, Alliant, but somehow I came into contact with Convex, and I managed to persuade. We'd agreed when we got the 4341 we had a use charge. It was supposed to create a replacement fund, so I called it in from the provost in 1985 and got to go ahead to buy a convex for about $500,000. And this is 20 times faster than the IBM 4341, which is like a VAX 11780. But Princeton was IBM territory in those days. So we got one of the first convexes, and that was around 10 megaflops. I mean, 10 times slower than a Cray, but the first one we had maybe had 64 megabytes. Within a year or two, we managed to upgrade to a C2 with 256 megabytes, but I had by that time developed a very good personal relationship with Convex people, in particular the founder, Steve Wallach, and he wound up, when he started shipping C2s and they were taking C1s as replacements, he wound up shipping one to me for my personal use. It went to the basement of my house in Princeton. I had to spend about $10,000 creating a room in the basement with air conditioning and so on. And the electricity bill was about $1,000 a month.
Yeah. The world's first personal data center.
But in fact, most of the codes I developed between 1986 and 1993 were first written on this C1 in my house. But then other proposals came along. There was Thinking Machines. And there were a bunch of very smart people, but they, I can't remember how many processors Thinking Machines had, but it was maybe 8,000, but very slow processes. And so I have kind of massive parallelization, and you really needed code completely tailored to that. So I rewrote my kind of baseline code in those days was Flow 67, it was being used. This is a 3D wing code with Euler equations, and that was used by aircraft companies to benchmark all these computers too. And
I think Chris might be looking at this list, but I mean, we should make clear how broadly used your codes have been. Is that what? I'm not sure if that's what you've got in front of you, but
yeah, I was just looking at the list. At some point, I was gonna kind of put a frame around this. That the first codes that you wrote, Flow 1 and 2 and Syn 1, those were in 1970.
Yes,
and up to today, 2007. You know, that's 37 years of computing history. So it's pretty amazing what's transpired in those 37 years and the number of architectures that you've gotten these codes to run on. Right there, you're talking about going from vector computers to massively parallel computers, and then at some point, you started writing code for more modern SMP, large SMPs, and then back to the parallel computers with today's x86 clusters, and who knows what's next. It's amazing. The amount of history is just unbelievable.
And also, I mean, we're talking about, I mean, just about what every kind of major aircraft from Boeing over the last 30 or so years?
Well, basically, in 1978, Boeing got my Flow 27 code, written by Dave Cohen, myself, in fact. This could run on it's kind of basically a finite element scheme that run on an arbitrary computational grid. And we had set it up for a wing, but you could do more complex geometry if you generated the necessary grid. And they used it in a wing fuselage version basically from 78 to 93, and that was when the 5767 777 were designed. And they had it connected with something estimated a correction for the viscous effects from in-house. So it was called Boeing 488 code, I think A488 or 488A. But at the same time, British Aerospace had got hold of Flow 57, and that was converted into codes with names like EJ30, which I think stood for Euler Jameson 30 or something. And they also added viscous corrections, and that was the kind of workhorse in England, but they were designing the Airbus wings in England.
And so were these codes, when you released them to these guys, or they got a hold of them, were you kind of doing this as like open source, or public domain? I mean, how are they getting these codes and then incorporating them into their own codes?
This is a... I had some not very happy experiences on this front. When we wrote codes like Flow 22 or Flow 27, there was really no established copyright law for software. I believe that it was, in fact, Bill Gates who managed to get copyright for software legally ratified, and that's around 1980. So codes like Flow 22 or Flow 27 were freely passed around. And in fact, Flow 22 was used to design this Canadair Challenger, but there was a consulting company in Los Angeles that was being paid by Canadair to run my code. I did eventually point out to Canadair that if they wanted to pay somebody, maybe they could have paid me to run this code.
Right, yeah.
But later on, it came quite friendly with the head of aerodynamics at Canadair, came Bombardier. But the Dutch got hold of Flow 22, the Dutch National Aerospace Establishment, and they issued a supposedly enhanced version called X-Flow 22, and they marketed it all over the place. I mean, I visited Italy and Air Marquis, for example, in 1985, and they were running Flow 22. Where did you get it from? We bought it from the Dutch NLR. Well, again, I mean, if you're going to buy the code, how about going to the original author? You know? So around 85, with Cobb, by that time also, Cray Research, I had been running my codes, the first development at Cray, and I thought we'd agreed that they could distribute it inside America, but that it shouldn't go outside America. But actually, they supplied Flow 57 along with a Cray to the British Royal Aircraft Establishment in somewhere around 1983, and apparently also to the Dutch NLR. So this code got all over the place through Cray. And around 1985, I said, well, this has got to stop, and I asserted that I did have copyright. And I told people that if they want the code, they're going to have to license them from me. And it was pretty much honored by companies like McDonnell Douglas, who did license Flow 67 and later on this so-called airplane code. It was the first code that could really do a complete aircraft. Wings, tails, a lot, engine, nacelles, but I actually went to China in 1986 at an international conference, and one of the papers presented by somebody from China was a comparison of the results of Flow 22 and Flow 27. Both codes have been written by Dave Cohen, myself, and we've never been in... This is the first time I've been in China. No contact with them. I don't know exactly how they got there. I do know that Flow 22 got its way into Russia because some Russians showed up with it one day. Princeton.
Nice.
Do you release your code under a specific license today, or?
Well, somewhere around about 1988, we formed this little tiny company, Intelligent Aerodynamics, with my wife, and we use that both to license software, but also to do consulting, because it turns out that if you really want a good answer, that it's better if I really can work closely with the actual engineers, as I have done with several companies, rather than just dumping a code in a vacuum.
So it's safe to say that Boeing's probably given you more than $25 than over... Oh, I guess that was NASA, so...
Actually, Boeing retained me as a consultant at $15,000 a year for about 15 years. But that terminated around about, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, when the guy who hired me, Paul Rubert, retired. He was the manager of CFD at Boeing. And on the other hand, I had close relationships with McDonnell Douglas. So since the merger, I continued to work with what's now called Boeing Phantom Works, and I am at the present time on some of their projects.
And can you, you know, give us, we talked a little bit about in the past, but maybe you could tell us these days, we were talking about it before we started recording, this balance between the computing work and the wind tunnel work as far as, you know, costs go and time and...
Well, I think the first thing to realize is that in the airplanes go through kind of three design stages, the so-called conceptual design, which is more just sort of, do you need a, what kind of range and how many passengers, let's say, for a commercial aircraft. And if they feel they've hit something which is in the right fit for airline needs, they do a preliminary design, which may take 2 or 3 years. The preliminary design you would have, if it's a business jet company like Gulfstream, maybe 20 or 30 engineers, and if it's Boeing, probably 400 or 500. And if it was Douglas, maybe 100. But you do a complete aerodynamic design and a kind of sketchy structural design insofar as you need to get a rough estimate, well, an estimate of what the structural weight's going to be, which, of course, if you have a bigger wing, it weighs more, so there's a trade-off. But you have to guarantee the performance if you're going to take orders, say, to airlines. So if you miss your guaranteed fuel consumption by more than 2% or something, you actually wind up paying penalties to the airlines. This happened on the MD-11, which was 7% high when it first flew. So you only need to have a pretty complete aerodynamic design at this preliminary design stage, which is something that costs some hundreds of millions of dollars. And you do wind tunnel testing at that point. But the wind tunnel testing is essentially to verify the design you arrived at by computer simulation. So nobody in Boeing, you might go through several wing design cycles, each of which goes as far as wind tunnel testing, but most of the variations are studied by computer, and then you build one or two models. And if it's a business jet company, you probably build just one, and provided that turns out all right, that's what you go with. When you go to the... If you get enough orders, say 100, that you decide to commit to build the plane, then you have to do the full detailed design. It includes detailed structures, where all the wiring goes, avionics, everything. Now you're talking about spending in the range of $10 billion if it's a big commercial aircraft. I think the Airbus 380 was maybe $12 billion. 777, I've even seen numbers as high as $14 billion attributed to it. But here is where you, like the Airbus 380s, got delayed by the wiring for the in-flight entertainment system. But while you do the detailed design, you need full structural loads, and that's to certify the plane, and there's something like 100,000 flight conditions that have to be examined, all kinds of situations where something's gone wrong, like a rudder's got fixed, fully deflected or something, or one engine's out, and it's actually, you can get the data much quicker at this point by building a model, because once you've got the model, you can just rotate it in the wind tunnel very quickly, and 100,000 CFD calculations, each of which is overnight, just takes too long and it's too expensive. So we really are using CFD to design the plane now, but when it gets to the detailed loads, we're still using wind tunnel models to get the full loads for the structure design. And there's some aspirations to replace wind tunnel for loads, but in order to do that, CPU costs have got to go down, and the confidence in CFD for these off-design conditions where you have separated flows would have to go up.
And these days, we talked, so we've gone from a refrigerator-sized machine to, you were using the Orion multi-systems device, which was like a little mini refrigerator, I suppose.
Yeah, the Orion multi-systems is desktop. It's about, 3 feet wide?
Oh, that's right. He's the smaller.
He's using the desktop, which is the 12-processor machine, which is about the size of a desktop computer. Yeah. He's actually got three of them now. After the company went out of business, I got him a couple more. And so he's got them stacked up in his breakfast room, humming away, churning out wing designs.
I should tell you that in the last 15 years, I focused particularly on trying to find an optimum design. So I have this software which basically applies a mathematical control theory to find out how to change the shape so as to improve the aerodynamic performance, basically to reduce the drag, which converts to reducing the fuel consumption. And a single run, you would actually look at something like 50 wing shapes, automatically changing the shape as you go. And then it turns out that it's not just one optimization, because you have to look at all kinds of different situations and trade off between optimizing to fly at one speed or another, or different lift coefficients. So I probably looked at 10,000 wings while working for this business jet design last year, and I was running these calculations on the Orion. These are now simulations with full viscous effects, and they need about 1 million mesh cells, and one flow calculation takes about 20 minutes with this 12-processor machine, but one optimization takes 3 hours for a single-point design and about 12 hours for a multi-point design, where you try to find a compromise between different design conditions, flight conditions. So I could do this overnight.
And you do most of your coding on the Mac, and then you send the jobs to the Orion, is that right? Or
actually, no, I need a bigger screen and a bigger keyboard. I carry this Mac around largely for demos. But you can run, I have this Macintosh right here in front of me, and it's actually just as powerful as a Cray XMP of about 1985.
Right.
With more memory. 2 gig of memory versus like 128 megabytes or 256. So you can do a 3D calculation and, in fact, a 3D wing optimization on this laptop, but that's leaving out the viscous effects. When you put in the viscous effects and do the Navier-Stokes equations, the Orion torpedo machine is about the minimum that will do it.
Yeah, which we should point out that the Orion machine is 12 1.2 gigahertz processors, each with a gig of memory.
Yeah.
I think the latest, we got one that had 2 gigs per
node, I think. I'm not sure, but anyway, it's enough memory for what I'm trying to do.
But he has 36 of those processors, 3 of those boxes, so he can run jobs. Well, I should let you tell how you run the jobs, but it's kind of interesting how you rotate the jobs through the different machines to keep something running all the time.
Well, I would run, as I say, when you're actually trying to find the best wing, you try to get the best wing shape, let's say, to cruise at Mach 0.85, but then somebody asks, what happens if you want to cruise faster at Mach 0.88 or something? So I would run several optimizations simultaneously. I find that three machines is about the maximum, because otherwise you just lose track of just too much data coming out and you can't keep track of what to do next. But it's very useful to have three of them. And for code development, the Orion is not so good because it doesn't have a fast single head node, and it's easier to write code starting without parallelization. See, a machine like the Orion, you have to have the message passing in place, and that's another layer of complexity on the code. But when you're trying to develop a new mathematical algorithm, you don't want to worry about this kind of thing. So, in fact, I use some of the other machines in my house to do code development, and then if I think it works, port it onto the Orion.
I should tell you, the audience, that one of the other machines that we got for him to use was a machine that I put together that's a dual core 2.2 gigahertz Opteron based machine that has 8 gigabytes of memory in it, and that one is one of the ones that you use to do the preliminary runs on and actually do some of your coding on, right?
It's easier to use that for code development, and it also turns out that it runs actually at about the same speed as the Orion, but of course at the time we bought the Orion, this
wasn't available. It also consumes a lot more energy.
Yeah.
Which is a factor, because you're running it in your house. which also contributes to the noise from the fans that are needed to cool that energy.
The noise is actually a serious issue, and I had some disagreements with my wife about locating these surrounds in this back room behind the kitchen. You can never hear it in the kitchen if you don't close the door. But I think the thing is that, you know, in the context of high-performance computing, the airplane wing design problem is pretty much you fly at a fixed speed, a long distance. So you're looking at a steady flow, and you really can calculate that with quite small, by modern standards, computers. 20 years ago, you needed a Cray or a convex, but now something like an Orion or even the two dual-core Optrons will do it.
So I think I was reading, though, about a massive Boeing data center. I mean, I guess they must need horsepower for all kinds of different things besides...
Well, I can tell you what actually drove the Boeing computing requirements. When they went to full CAD, and their first airplane that they did that was a 777, they took a license on Catia, which comes out of the Dassault company in France. It was marketed by IBM. They wound up buying, I don't know how many IBM computers, but it was to run Catia.
Right, so it's probably the P-series systems, the power boxes.
I'm not sure which machines they were, because we're going back to, this is 19... I guess mid-90s. Well, early 90s.
Okay.
So I think there might have been still things like IBM 3094s.
Yeah.
But there's a tremendous computational requirements for this CAD. I have to tell you, that when I first tried to do a calculation of a complete aircraft, I asked Douglas for geometry of the DC-862, which I thought was a nice, clean plane, and they said they didn't have it. It said they got the blueprints. I eventually managed to get data for one or two planes, and in those days getting digital data was very difficult because the planes weren't designed as CAD. And I have geometry, for example, for the Lockheed SR-71, but somebody digitized that maybe 7 or 8 years ago at a time when the plane was no longer in use.
Right. Speaking of the SR-71, I did just want to touch on this before I forgot. I mean, on your website, you have some of these different designs you've done, and there looks like there's a kind of double-wide SR-71 on here, and then there's... I'm going to put the pictures on our website with the interview, but there's a picture as well of kind of these two birds locked together. These are just kind of experiment... These are designs you think of, and...
This is just... It amuses me to think of crazy concepts of flying, and most of which, of course, couldn't possibly fly, like the bird flying round and round in circles. It's a kind of conceivable that nature could have arrived at a helicopter if you'd got a bird just rotating instead of flying forwards.
But so these are just jokes. These are just amusement.
You know, when I'm at a meeting or something and I get nervous, I need to sort of sketch. So I just sketch whatever crazy shape comes into my head, and sometimes it seems worth saving.
But
so
some of the concepts are pretty funny when you see these, actually, when you post these. The readers will be able to check it out. They're pretty funny, some of them.
Actually, I was thinking if we, the one with the two birds together, if we sent some of those to North Korea, I think that would definitely get their attention.
I just say they're just purely whimsical, but I don't know, it's an outlet for me. And sometimes there's a good germ of truth. I have something called the fat 777, and that's a sort of spherical shape with wings. But you can argue that because the sphere has a minimum surface area for a given volume, that it would reduce the skin friction.
I think
just
this is
flying ball.
That's on the list, right? It's the one down here, I think.
Yeah.
Well, that's one, but there's another one. This is, but this kind of thing.
You're going to have to post these and
yeah.
put some pointers to them so people know what we're laughing at.
And I mean, you know,
it's the kind of joke that doesn't do well.
No,
on a radio show.
I'm gonna put them up at the front of the webpage. So what are you, what are the problems you're working the hardest on today? It's just constantly going after efficiency and.
Well, let me say that I felt I actually managed to do a simulation of a complete aircraft using a Cray in 1985. We published it in January 86. And that code, which we called Airplane, because it could do complete aircraft, including the engine and nacelles, but not the engines, but the flow through the nacelles, was used successfully by Douglas on redesigning the MD-11 when they had drag problems. But then I got more interested in trying to find the best design. If you can calculate what happens, that's interesting, but it doesn't tell you how to make a better design. So then I tried to come up with this mathematical approach to optimizing the aerodynamic shape, in particular the wing, which is, I mean, the wing is what matters on an airplane. I mean, the fuselage is just a tube with some seats in it. The wing is really everything. But it's important because there's almost no commercial airplane flying now where it doesn't look like you could get 15% or so improvement purely on the improved aerodynamics. And if you think about the environmental impact, actually, when you burn hydrocarbon fuel, you generate water and you generate carbon dioxide. And it turns out that for each 10 pounds of gasoline you burn, you create about 30 pounds of carbon dioxide. And a 747 on a long-range flight takes off, burns at least one-third of its takeoff weight in fuel. So it means that, in fact, it puts the takeoff weight, which is 400 tons of carbon dioxide, into the atmosphere in a single flight. Or even talking about the water vapor, just the carbon dioxide. So this is a real issue.
So it's more of a, I mean, efficiency thing right now, as opposed to, you know, I was curious just about speed as well. Just, you know, if you look at air travel over the last three decades or so, it's probably not fair to compare it to computing or another field, but we just haven't seen the as dramatic advances maybe in flight travel as we have in some other technology fields. But are we mostly focused on efficiency as opposed to kind of a dramatic change in flight right now?
Well, the reason we're flying subsonically is that the lift-drag ratio, which translates directly into how much fuel you burn, is about three times lower for a supersonic aircraft than a subsonic aircraft. Something like a Boeing 777 has a lift-drag ratio of around 20. Concorde was 7.5. And you just, it's not economic to fly supersonically when you take into account the huge fuel consumption. But it's similar in other forms of transport. I mean, ships got up to like 30 knots, and then that was the best speed. Ground transportation, you know, around 100 miles an hour. Well, on a German Autobahn, maybe faster, but on an American freeway, a little less, you know.
Yeah, so around here it seems about 45 miles an hour.
So, but on the other hand, the fuel burn is something like half what it was for the first jet transports, and that's more from improvements in the fuel consumption of reduced fuel consumption by going to turbofan engines as opposed to straight jet engines and anything else. So, the biggest improvement, say, in the last 30 years in jet transports has been in the improvements in the engine efficiency, but there's still room for improvements in the straight aerodynamics and structures, which all translate into more efficiency.
And aren't they doing a lot of work to try and reduce the noise of the jet engines?
Also
and stuff
the
like
noise, because the jet noise varies, I can't remember whether it's the sixth or the eighth power of the jet velocity. So if you have a turbofan engine with a lower jet velocity and a larger mass flow, the noise comes down. We're actually at the point where the engine noise is not much greater than the noise from the whole airframe. and he's doing takeoff, well, certainly doing landing. So this is, I know it's not so, I mean, it doesn't sound exciting, but making a better subsonic airplane still has tremendous impact on the cost of flying and the environment. Flying supersonically, because supersonic aircraft generate a sonic boom, you're not actually legally allowed to fly supersonic over land on a commercial aircraft at the present time. And there are a lot of efforts to design a supersonic business jet, but that seems to be, it's scientifically interesting. It seems to be spending a lot of money for a very small, wealthy subsegment of the population.
Actually, I mean, I wanted to ask you about business jets because they're getting a lot of press these days, and the price is coming down, not to the point, obviously, where anyone can afford it, but, I mean, a larger class of rich people can afford this kind of travel. What do you see in the next 20 years with the business jets and or this type of craft?
I'm quite curious. I mean, I've been working with business jet companies. I mean, a top-end business jet like a Gulfstream G5 sells for about $40 million. There are now these so-called very light jets, which the one that's got off to the quickest starts, the Eclipse, which is selling for something like $1.5 million. Still, actually, I tried to persuade a bunch of my students. I said, why don't we, you had to put down a 10% deposit. I think at that time it was, $129,000 to guarantee delivery date and guaranteed delivery price. And I said, well, for the 10 of us, we put down $13,000 each, sort of like buying a future on the stock market, because, in fact, the price will go up. So maybe you sell your delivery position for $2 million instead of $1.3 million. On the other hand, you can get airplanes do fly for 40, 50 years nowadays. B-52s are still flying, and you have a 30-year mortgage on a house, so why can't you take a 90% 30-year mortgage on an airplane?
Right.
So you can imagine this, but I think the thing is that, you know, an ordinary person can't get in there and fly a little jet plane. It's too complicated. So if you have to have a pilot flying you, it's more like a limousine service. It's not going to be that cheap.
Right. What about flying cars? Are we ever going to? it's a pet topic on the register.
I've seen all kinds of crazy concepts, and the trouble is that a car is a terrible aerodynamic shape because it's short and fat, and the flow separates off the back end. So, if you wanted to have drag low enough for reasonable efficiency, it
has to be a long, thin shape.
You can imagine something whose wings folded, and I mean, things have been proposed, but they wind up being bad cars and bad airplanes.
Yeah, I've seen some that I've seen some that involve, you know, hovering using fans, and those seem like they would be horribly inefficient.
Yeah, they are. Yes, I mean, they're just inefficient cars and inefficient airplanes. So in the end, it's still better to drive to your local, like the Palo Alto Airport, and get in a plane if you've got enough money to do it. Yeah?
Right. Maybe it'll be dirigibles will come back, be in fashion again, and we can take Hangar 1 and use it to park a whole bunch of small dirigibles in it.
Well, I think the other thing is, if you think that everybody's going to be flying their own airplane, the air traffic control problems are absolutely horrendous.
Another argument for dirigibles, because if they're soft, actually if it's a blimp, it's soft, and they can just bounce off of each other.
And so a new startup was born.
Moved away from the high-performance computing. But I think I should say that within the aircraft industry, we got a kind of plateau. You could design the basic aerodynamic design of commercial aircraft. Less so military, because it's not quite clear what military aircraft wants. Is it a tighter turn or what? But we can't, if we want to go to a higher level of simulation, there are methods of trying to simulate basically unsteady flows around high lift systems. They're tremendously expensive computationally, and that's where we'd have to go to these current kind of teraflop, even petaflop machines. That's not even enough to do a full simulation of a turbulent flow. Actually, I've estimated that you need around about speed of about 10 power 20 to 10 power 22 flops. The thing is that current top-end machines are at about 100 teraflops, 10 to the 14th, something like the Japanese Earth Simulator on this machine at Columbia at NASA, Ames. And that's a million times faster than like the Cray XMP of 25 years ago. So if you manage to make another factor of a million in the next 25 years, maybe you can do these full unsteady turbulent simulations. But examples of where you would need this kind of thing are the flow inside a jet engine, where I've been involved with a project at Stanford and trying to simulate a subpiece of the jet engine, like 30-degree sector. We're still talking about running a computer like BlueJean for 4 weeks or something with 8,000 processors. And this is not really useful as a design tool at the present time. But,
you've obviously done work with NASA in the past. I mean, are they, as far as they're looking to revamp the shuttle design, and, you know, are there similar considerations for NASA as well?
NASA's had extreme fluctuations in their kind of research policy and objectives. There's an associate director of NASA for aeronautics, and the average tenure in that job has been sort of 18 months over the last 30 years. So keep on having changes of direction, but right now there's Lisa Porter in the job, and she's emphasizing fundamental research. Previously, they were emphasizing kind of applications. NASA was heavily into trying to design a second-generation supersonic transport aircraft around the year 2000. Well, actually, my software was heavily used in those studies by NASA people. But now they're talking about back to fundamental research and understanding turbulence and very high-speed flow with chemical reaction, hypersonics, and so on. I think so they're kind of backing off the sort of focus on airplane design that did drive the NASA aeronautics research maybe 10 years ago. I think NASA should probably be doing fundamental research, and there's open questions even in computational fluid dynamics when you talk about resolving unsteady, separated turbulent flows, which are still far from being solved and may need, as I say, bigger computers than even what we've got. But, of course, high-performance computing is now being driven by other things like computational chemistry and so on, probably more than...
Well, that brings me to another question, is what are some of the other areas that that you think your code might be applied? Like the one that comes to my mind that we've talked about in the past quite a lot is like wind energy, and it seems like there would be application for your codes in that industry as well.
Yes, I believe these codes could be adapted to look at wind turbine design, and I've thought about it, but it's hard to find research grants. Maybe I didn't try hard enough, but during the kind of 70s and 80s, I didn't have to spend very much time getting research grants from people like the Office of Naval Research. And nowadays, it's become very, very bureaucratic, and you wind up with 50 proposals of which they fund three or something. You can spend more time writing proposals than you're doing the research. And it's coming.
Alternative energy is a very hot area of investment right now, so maybe somebody out there will hear this and call you up.
I hope so, because I think there's things we could do in these codes. were targeted for transonic flow, but they in fact could run on the wind turbine regime, I think, and the automatic shape optimization could be applied to the blades of these wind turbines. It's of course, the other thing is you can use similar techniques in astrophysics, and they are. I was in fact involved in one of the first attempts to do that at Princeton with joint work with Jerry Ostreicher and his postdoc. But I've been, astrophysics is, this is kind of what we tried to do, was to simulate kind of formation of galaxies and evolution of the universe, and that's become much more sophisticated nowadays. But the problem with those kind of simulations is that you're integrating over a very long time. So if you introduce a small error at each time step, the accumulated error at the end of a billion years might be such that the answer's kind of meaningless. And when you're doing a steady flow past an airplane, it's kind of self-correcting.
Yes. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I regret to say that I think we're coming near to the end of our time. I didn't know if there was anything in particular we should cover before we close out.
I mean, there's enough information. We could talk for hours, so maybe we should do this again sometime.
I think we will definitely have to do that. Anthony, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. We went covered quite a bit of ground, and really appreciate you coming in today.
Well, it's fun for me, and well, thank you for inviting me. You were looking for a cowboy that could make you act right. Well, you said there was something about a honky-tonk that brought out your wilder side. You could not be responsible as you were unsupervised, and you just might need a gentleman help you make it home all right. I said, I'm not your daddy, but you can call me daddy tonight. Well, I'm not your daddy, but you can call me daddy tonight. Well, I tell you bedtime stories, and I took you in real time. Tell my mama, 'cause she might get hauled up tight. I said,